You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
There's a well-known conspiracy theory that says there's a secret elite group of people who rule the world. There's a lesser-known theory that this elite group is comprised of satanic, pedophile, lizard people. One man has made it his mission to tell the world about this threat to world freedom, and his name is David Icke. On this episode of Monster Talk, we'll be talking with John Ronson about his experiences with David Icke, about lizard people, about child sex abuse amongst the elites, and about being
quite
publicly shamed.
We've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm your host, Blake Smith. When it comes to conspiracy theories, any that are predicated on the idea that monsters or aliens or monster aliens are crossbreeding with humans are easily dismissed because that's not how human reproduction works. It is often difficult to get two humans to successfully make a healthy baby, and they're the same species. We'd be more likely to get a satyr-like goat people from overly amorous shepherds than any kind of hybrid from a pairing with non-earthlings. Not only would we not be genetically compatible, but it is completely implausible that they would even have DNA. That particular complex chemical arrangement is specific to Earth life, where it evolved over millions of years and has diversified into the myriad arrangements which comprise the flora and fauna of our planet. That being said, people still believe in conspiracies. And in the world of strange conspiracies, the idea that there are lizard people who can assume human guise and rule through centuries-old bloodlines is quite popular. It's not up there with the fear of toxins and big pharma, but it has thousands of believers, and many successful books and TV shows have explored the idea uncritically. I'm not being closed-minded when I say that there are no lizard people ruling the Earth. There are some ideas that are so absurd that they're self-evidently false, or at least they should be. Lizard people have appeared in fiction and legend, notably in some ripping yarns by Robert E. Howard and in the television series V. The biggest proponent of the idea, and certainly one of the people who have helped codify the lizard man narrative, is David Icke. Author and researcher John Ronson did a really interesting documentary about Icke back in the 90s, and I managed to catch up with him while I was on a publicity tour for his newest book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. John's always fun to talk to, and I was delighted at how much time he was able to give to us to discuss some of his older work. But I can tell you that his new book is one of his best and is well worth reading, though you may feel a bit gut-punched throughout the experience. Let's have some
Monster Talk.
John Ronson is the author of books, radio, and television shows. I'm especially fond of Them, Adventures with Extremists, and The Men Who Stare at Goats, and the book that we talked about in his previous visit to Monster Talk, which was The Psychopath Test. His most recent book was just released and is titled So You've Been Publicly Shamed. A link to select works from his oeuvre will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. So I'd like to welcome back to Monster Talk, John Ronson.
Hi, how are you doing, Blake?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I would say I was okay, but actually that would be a bit of a lie. I have been on a book tour for 6 weeks, and whilst I've been assiduously using hand sanitizer and, like, things to stave off colds, it failed me, and now I've got a cold.
No, you definitely get exposed to a lot of germs on the road. I know that feeling. So, yeah, in fact, yeah. Karen can't be here tonight, and she's having a terrible cold and a pregnancy. These are not related, but so she says hello and wishes you the best. So, but I asked you here today to talk about content from one of your older books so that we could discuss an idea that's sort of related to the theme of this monster show. But I also believe there's some sort of theme crossover with your newest book that will come out when we talk about it. So I really enjoyed Them, Adventures with Extremists, as well as the video series that came out with it, The Secret Rulers of the World. And this was probably the first time I encountered this idea about David Icke and the idea that there were secretly reptilian beings controlling the world.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know how many of our listeners will be familiar with David and his transition from his previous life into his sort of current role. Can you tell us a little bit about who David was before he became who he is now and what happened to him?
Sure. David was a household name in Britain. So he started life as a professional soccer player. He was a goalkeeper for, I think, Leicester City, which is a kind of mid to lower range British soccer team, mid-range, I guess. But then his football career was cut short early with arthritis, and he became a sports personality. So like a TV presenter, would present the snooker, and I think would sometimes present Grandstand, which was the big, you know, sports show on the BBC. So he became really famous, really well-known. And then he kind of transitioned into becoming a spokesman for the Green Party in Britain. So, you know, that sort of took people by surprise a little bit. And then he suddenly announced, apropos of nothing, in about 1991, he went on to Britain's biggest chat show, The Wogan Show, and announced that he was the son of God, and there was going to be earthquakes and hurricanes, and he was the son of God, and he had to only wear turquoise. And there was an extraordinary moment when the audience were laughing, and David Icke said something like, "I'm glad there's so much laughter in the audience tonight, because laughter is a great healer." And Terry Wogan, the interviewer, said, "But they're not laughing with you, they're laughing at you." And there was like a scream of hysterical laughter in the audience. And then after that, David Icke was mocked. And, you know, you couldn't turn on a kind of British version of Leno or Letterman without the comedian, you know, making a joke about David Icke. He was just a figure of ridicule. And he vanished for a little while. And then he came back, first as a kind of pretty regular mainstream sort of conspiracy theorist. When I say mainstream, I mean just like, you know, just a kind of regular conspiracy theorist talking about, you know, the New World Order and the Bilderberg Group. And then suddenly he came out with a new theory, which is the thing that made him probably most famous at all, which was that the ruling elite, the shadowy cabal that secretly rules the world, are actually blood-drinking, child-sacrificing, paedophile lizards who have adopted human form. And that's when I kind of got involved with David Icke, when he came out with his lizard theory.
Wow. So you got to talk to him. I mean, you traveled with him and videoed him, right?
Yeah, I spent a long time with him. I still see him from time to time. We're still in touch. But yeah, back then, I remember my producer, Fenton Bailey, said to me, you know, you've got to make a film about David Icke. It's this kind of, you know, he's coming up with this kind of crazy new theory about giant lizards secretly ruling the world. You've got to make a film about it. And it didn't really engage me. I thought this is just too, you know, it's too crazy. And obviously David's, you know, troubled. But then what I discovered, I tell you what it was. I had a death threat from some Islamic fundamentalists. And so I went to see the Board of Deputies for British Jews, like a kind of Jewish defense organization, because I was kind of scared that I might be killed. So I went to see the Board of Deputies. And when I was sitting in the waiting room about to see the Board of Deputies, I picked up a copy of the Jewish Chronicle, and there was an article in there about David Icke, about how he believed that giant lizards secretly ruled the world. And it was quite obvious that when he said giant lizards, he was using code, and what he actually meant was that Jews secretly ruled the world. And I just thought that was so interesting that people thought that when David Icke said lizards, he meant Jews. And that kind of brought the story alive for me.
You covered that really nicely in your documentary. And I wonder, I didn't feel like you made a specific conclusion per se in the show. Where do you fall on that now? I mean, do you think David means Jews, or do you think David means lizards?
I think David means lizards, but I think some of his followers, you know, are anti-Semites and take it to mean Jews. And, you know, David's toyed with that thing. I mean, there was a brief moment a number of years ago when David's website linked to, like, The International Jew, the Henry Ford book, like, you should read The International Jew. And I actually asked David about that much more recently, and he said it was his, you know, he had an anti-Semitic webmaster, and as soon as it was drawn to his attention, he no longer linked to it. You know, I don't think it would be fair to kind of demonize David as an anti-Semite. I think he's much more complicated than that.
So he seems to have managed to come from what seemed like it might have been a pretty serious mental break of some kind to at least maintaining a sort of cogent thread, right? I mean, it's, I would say, biologically implausible that people are really lizards, but he's consistent with it and is able to maintain lectures and do videos and that sort of thing and make a business out of it.
Yeah, he's done really well. I mean, I followed him to Vancouver because I knew that there was a group of anti-racists, like the Anti-Defamation League and the Canadian Jewish Congress and various sort of more, you know, militant young anti-racist groups, who were all getting together to try and, you know, battle David Icke. So I knew that, you know, he was going to go around Canada doing the lizard talk, and then all these people were going to try and stop him and get his books seized and incinerated. And so I made a film called David Icke, The Lizards and the Jews, which was all about his trip to Vancouver. And there's also a chapter in my book, Them, about that, called There Are Lizards and There Are Lizards. And it was extraordinary because, I mean, frankly, the people trying to attack David Icke came over crazier than David did. And David was really successful. I mean, he was filling big theatres. He was filling probably 1,000-seater theatre with his theories. So you're right, he had managed to... he had managed to really tap a nerve. You know, he was hitting the sort of spiritualist, anti-New World Order, you know, conspiracy world, and had become, probably after Alex Jones, became like the second biggest, most successful conspiracy theorist in the world with his lizard theory.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, when you're with him, I can't diagnose him, you know, and I would be absolutely wrong to try and diagnose
him. No, and I wouldn't either.
But, yeah, but what I would say is that when you're with him, he's just a pleasant, you know, I like him. I like David, and I've stayed in touch with him over the years. Russell Brand has put us together a few times because Russell's both a fan of mine and a fan of his. So I've done some TV shows with the three of them and with the two of them, and you know, kept in touch with them a little bit that way. And yeah, he's still going. But the thing, the anti-racists, the people who were trying to like destroy David, so they got various public appearances cancelled and radio shows cancelled, and then they decided to cap it all by launching a custard pie attack on him at a bookstore in Vancouver. And that was the climax of my documentary. They thought they would publicly shame him. They would humiliate him in front of his fans by throwing a custard pie at him. So we filmed it without telling David that this was going to happen because we didn't want to, what's the word? I didn't want to mess with unfolding reality.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. And anyway, the pie attackers threw the pie and it missed David and instead splattered all over the children's book section. So it really backfired and David came out the winner.
I've seen that actually, and I thought it was a very well put together video.
I loved it. I love doing that particular film.
Do you know if it's for sale?
You can probably find it. I think you can find like a sort of grainy copy of it on YouTube. But my written version of it is in my book, Them.
Yes.
So you can kind of read everything that happened in Them.
Yeah, I've actually, the version I've seen was very grainy, and I've been trying to find a better version. And I haven't been able. I would love to buy it if it was for sale. So
I've got a kind of beta of it, and in fact, I showed it quite recently at a museum in Brooklyn, and so I did a couple of screenings of it, and that's really the only time it's been shown in any decent way in 15 years.
Wow. So I've seen. So David always seems sincere. He seems very charismatic, but. You know, if you listen to what he's saying, it doesn't, it's impossible. I don't, does he have any kind of science background? I mean, does anyone ever ask, everyone always gets into the, well, how could they be in power? And I rarely hear people or rarely see articles where he's directly confronted with the implausibility of the premise.
Of the science. I certainly didn't do that. He would talk about how some people are still born with tails. I don't know. I don't know anybody who's done that.
Yeah, I don't.
I think probably because we can all assume that the ruling elite aren't lizards. but I will tell you something really interesting about David, which is that years ago, around the time of the lizard theory first coming out, he was also saying that the ruling elite are all paedophiles. They're all in a paedophile ring together. And everybody mocked that as much as they mocked the lizard theory. And sure enough, years and years and years later, I don't know if you're following it, but he kind of was right about the paedophiles. I mean, so many powerful members of the British establishment in the 1970s and 1980s have now been exposed as being paedophiles. And only David Icke was saying it. Back then. Now, of course, you could say, well, a broken clock is right twice a day. but I would say, actually, there's something else going on. I think this is really interesting, actually. I'm going to say this, and you can tell me what you think about this. I think David Icke, because he was a kind of marginalized outsider, because he'd been, like, attacked and humiliated and mocked, he was empathizing with other people who nobody believed. So he was listening. You know, he was going to sources that everybody else thought was nuts. And sometimes the sources were nuts, like, you know, lizards rule the world, and the New World Order rules the world, and blah, blah, blah. But he was also finding people on the fringes who were saying, you know, I was the victim of a VIP paedophile ring that involved politicians and celebrities and bankers. And everybody thought that was nuts, but David Icke was listening to those people. And 20 years later, those people's stories are being validated.
It seems plausible to me.
So the fact that he was marginalized sort of sent him to those places where people turned out to be telling the truth.
And that they would probably seek him out as someone who is willing to listen, right? So
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really interesting because I think it gets to questions about the meritocracy. It's like people didn't believe David Icke because he was nuts. But actually, in that particular thing about the paedophiles, David Icke was onto something. And nobody listened to him because he didn't fit into the concept of the meritocracy. People didn't think... we should listen to David Icke because he wasn't of merit.
Although it does have that risk of the conspiratorial view would probably, I'm just off the top of my head from having read a lot of these things, They deliberately leaked it to David Icke, knowing that when he said it, it would help make it even less plausible that people would believe it.
Right, right. Yeah. What I don't know...
Disinformation,
probably
right?
...probably find out is, like, where David Icke got the paedophile information from. But what I can tell you is that all these years later, you know, it's really... It's no longer considered crazy.
Wow.
I think that politicians in the 1980s, close to Margaret Thatcher, and lots of British celebrities, you know, household names in the 70s and 80s, really were all part of the paedophile ring together.
It is, you know, that's the thing. It's like there's this sort of comical aspect to it because lizards don't rule the world, all right? But then there's this other side, which is the here's a guy who seems to have had something gone horribly wrong with his reasoning. But what are you going to do, right? I mean, the idea is out there. And amazingly to me, people aren't just either, you know, mocking him or feeling sorry for him. People are believing him.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, well, and the paedophile stuff all coming out, you know, is going to really help that. I mean, I think David's going to have like a second wind now because that aspect of what he was saying all those years ago is coming true.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was interesting, putting aside the paedophiles for a second, it was really interesting to me when I was in Vancouver that, you know, the people of Vancouver were much more on David Icke's side. And his right to free speech and his right to talk about the lizards and the paedophiles than they were on the side of the people on my side of the fence, you know, the anti-racist groups and so on, who were trying to stop him. I mean, they became the villains, you know, in public opinion in Vancouver. The people trying to stop David became the villains. And David sold out, you know, this theatre in Vancouver. I can't remember the name of it, but it was a big theatre, and David sold it out.
Do you think the sellout crowd was in part a response to a response to people trying to silence him?
Yeah, I'd say to an extent. Yeah, I would. Yeah.
So,
I know that's really interesting. Is that people just did not want, you know, to be told, you know, what to think by people who were trying to do, you know, the work of sort of social justice campaigners.
Have you ever seen the Jesse Ventura conspiracies TV series he did?
No, although I annoyingly appear in one, and they and they re-edited me to make it look like I was a big believer in all of that stuff. I've always felt slightly slightly annoyed by that series. I've never seen it, but I know I'm in it, and don't come over that well.
Well, David is on the show, too, and basically there's this beautiful scene, which I'm sure is heavily edited in favor of Ventura, but of David basically arguing with Ventura over whether or not his theories are crazy or not. I mean, it would be like him and Alex Jones having an argument. It would just be to a third party who's interested in this overall concept of conspiracy theories. It's a fascinating thing to see these two go ballistic at each other.
So, that's really funny.
It really is.
You know, all these years later, I mean, I had a great 10 days in Vancouver with David. And you know, that great film and that great adventure happened because of David. And in the end, the fact that he enriched my life in that way is my big memory of the whole thing. And now when I see him, I feel happy to see him. And we always have a nice chat. And I like him. I like David.
Well, I mean, if you can put aside the fact that he has strange theories, his intent has always seemed to be to alert people to a danger that he perceives as quite real.
And as history is showing, some of it was true.
There you go.
I mean, you know, back then, in the early 90s or the mid-90s, actually even the late 90s, people assumed that people like us, you know, rational people, assumes that everything David Icke said was nuts. And, you know, it's so interesting to me that 15 years later, a huge sliver of it has been proved to have been true.
And we're all going to be eating crow when it turns out he is the Son of God. So,
I'm the Queen of the Lizard.
So your newest book is on public shaming. And
but obviously, everything we just talked about just now is, you know, there was an awful lot of public shaming involved. David was publicly shamed when he first came out with the Son of God theory, and then the anti-racist tried to publicly shame David, when he was doing the lizard stuff in Vancouver. So
sure, but that was all in the...
There was a lot of shaming in it.
Yeah, but it was such a primitive time. This was before social media.
Yeah.
So you really couldn't get the kind of traction that you can now.
Yeah, exactly. Funnily enough, I wonder what would happen with David now on social media.
I mean, he's sort of on, so he's on Twitter a lot, complaining, but I don't know how much traction he gets.
Yeah. He's not the sort of person that social media would go for, actually.
No, probably not.
No, because he's not, because what social media goes on, this is what my new book's about, is about, you know, we attack and destroy people who misuse their privilege. But, which is, of course, a good thing to attack. But we're doing it in a very trigger-happy way, and there's a lot of scalps, and a lot of people are being ruined as a result of it. And we don't want to think about that. But I'm sort of forcing us to think about that with this new book.
No, I think you're doing a good job. It's an excellent read. There's something strange that happens, and it's happening. I think this is my perception, right, as... I'll be honest, I've never felt like I was ever really truly a part of any community. So I've always been like, when I'm in a community, I'm also sort of silently observing it, right? You know, even if it's just always, so I'm fascinated to see, as I am involved in various social groups, they inevitably dissolve into inner turmoil. There's always some kind of fight going on or argument. And social media is...
With the skeptic community.
Oh, it, for sure, in the skeptic community. But it's what's true for the skeptics community is true for church communities I was with before that. And just all kinds of various groups, gaming communities. You know, I'm not much of a joiner, but I see it happen again and again. I've had people tell me it happens in... academic circles as well, where
my God.
Yeah.
So, tell me about it.
I mean, I know people who have dropped out of academia. That was what they spent, you know, years and years to get involved with, to do research in, and then found that the toxicity of the social environment destroyed any joy that they had.
Yeah. I found members of the academic community to be stunningly cruel.
Cruel. Yeah, good word. Good word. And I think so. Social media sort of removes the empathy factor. I think Louis C.K. did a bit where he talks about some kid calling another kid fat and how you feel powerful. But then you sort of see the sad look on the person's face and you think, oh, maybe I shouldn't do that. But then online, you do the fat, you get the thrill and you never get the negative consequences.
Yeah. And I would meet, I mean, you know, in that line is really what I wanted to write this book for, because I wanted people, I love the fact, you know, the best thing that people say about this new book is they say it's terrifying to read it. It feels terrifying. And it's because I am humanizing the people that we are destroying, and I'm making people feel what it feels like to be destroyed by us. And I sort of go into people's homes and I see the terror and I see, you know, the anxiety and the agony. I think my book is like a sort of 70,000 word examination of that Louis C.K. bit.
Yeah, and it's very good. I don't think I can overstate how entertaining and I think socially important it is. It's really quite different from a lot of the other stuff that you've done. Not that those weren't great.
It's about us a lot. Well, I suppose all my books are about us in a way, but
yeah.
I definitely felt more passionate. I felt like my other books, the passion came from enjoying the kind of absurdity of the situations and writing a kind of Vonnegut-esque, like, romp into dark and serious worlds. But this book is less like that. This book is, it feels kind of wrenched from my heart more, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, this will sound rather non sequitur, but like The Men Who Stare at Goats, right? There's a couple of stories in there that I thought were extremely poignant. And one was the Barney the Dinosaur torture story.
Right.
And I guess the point of that was a horrible torture was taking place. But because the story involved the song from Barney the Dinosaur, the news coverage was comical. And the other was the CIA LSD story, which was pertinent to me because by the time I was a young lad growing up, my mom had heard that story as an urban legend about people giving LSD and suicides and all this sort of stuff. But both of those stories were not a part of the film. So in some sense, the film was doing the same sort of thing you were kind of complaining about in the book.
Right. Although the Barney stuff did come into the end of the movie, but quite quickly, but it did come into the end of the movie. In fact, that Barney clip of, like, everybody on the Today program, Katie Couric and people, you know, laughing about the funny torture, it does make it to the end of the movie. But I know what you're saying. I think the people who made the movie had a sort of slightly different agenda to me. And I'm not saying that as a criticism at all, but they wanted to make a film that was really kind-hearted about the people who were part of this, you know, crazy military unit that thought they could kill goats just by staring at them. This sort of idealism of military, extreme, out-of-the-box thinking. They wanted to make a film that was, like, incredibly empathetic and kind-hearted about those people. So that was, like, their agenda. And I think they did that really well. I think it's a really sweet-natured film.
Oh, it is. Very. It's very sweet. And yeah. I really like the darkness in your book, John.
Well, you know, I just think, honestly, look, you know what? I mean, I know that that when you sell the film rights to a book, you have to let the filmmaker
do.
And I really, and you know what? About a year ago, me and Peter Strawn, who wrote the screenplay for the film, watched it together at a festival I was curating, a film festival. And we both felt exactly the same way about the film that we felt when we first saw it 4 or 5 years ago. So we kind of really liked it. It's different to my book, but there's a real sweetness to it and a kind of comedy to it that we both really liked. And some of the film's hilarious. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, some people have said to me that they really hated the film, but I don't.
I didn't mean to put you in defensive mode about it. It's a very enjoyable film. It's a fantastic book. And they're similar, but they're different. I guess what it was just, it struck me that it sort of taps into this whole problem of when you're trying to tell a story, you work to get the story out. And then everyone who hears it interprets it through their own filters, you know?
Yeah, I've noticed that happening a lot. I mean, that's happening with this new book of mine.
Yeah.
Publicly saying.
Even the story, like, about the woman who told the AIDS joke, and I won't spoil it because that's a fantastic part of the book. She tells this horrible AIDS joke. It's a joke. I mean, if Gilbert Gottfried had said that on stage, it wouldn't surprise me at all, right?
Yeah.
But she wasn't Gilbert Gottfried, and everyone takes it out of context, and that seems like such a risk online that without the context, or, you know, without knowing the full story. And heck, even if you do something yourself or you say something yourself, maybe from one day to the next, you can't remember what the context was that drove you to say a particular thing, you know?
If I ever see old tweets of mine, like once in a while, like something I said like a year ago is retweeted, and I sort of see it, I always think, God, did I say that? I have no idea what I'm talking about.
Right. Well, I know you're running out of time, but what seems missing from, not necessarily from your book, but from the whole process of shaming is the idea of a redemption narrative. Like, everyone knows how to publicly shame, and then they'll forget what happened and maybe look it up in a Google search. But how do people get forgiveness anymore? Have you got any ideas about that?
Well, quite honestly, I mean, the reason why I kind of didn't put a redemption narrative into this new book is because it's a really dark story. I was with broken people. And if you put in a redemption narrative, you're kind of letting us shamers off the hook, you know? So I sort of deliberately, so the book does end quite darkly. But honestly, the best way to survive a shaming, if you're in the middle of being shamed, the best way to survive is to stay completely silent for about a year. And thank God, you know, the human brain forgets things eventually.
It sure does.
People will forget, you know, the terrible thing that you did. So even though as social creatures, what we want to do is connect and communicate and explain, when you're being shamed, just shut the hell up for like a year or 2 years. And maybe, you know, time will be your friend.
It works for a lot of people, including very bad people.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay.
It works for everybody, though. Some people are tainted forever.
Well,
and of course, the internet helps to taint forever.
It does, if anyone bothers to look things up, which they rarely do. I could talk more and more about this. But, okay, quick, I always like to ask this question. What's your favorite monster, John?
Oh, God. God.
God is a terrible monster, John, but I don't think that's appropriate. I can't put that in there. But
okay. Also, it makes no sense. What is my favorite monster? Give me a second.
Sure.
Cut the long silence.
Oh, absolutely. Or I could put crickets in. Either way.
It's the girl in Thomas Alfredson's Let the Right One In.
Ooh, sweet. Yeah. No one's given that one before. Yeah, she's quite creepy. Yeah, great. Okay, John, everybody needs to get off this episode and then immediately go buy this book. It's fantastic. And
so you've been publicly shamed.
That's right.
And the other book we discussed in detail, I'm being my own bibliography here, was Them, my first book, Them, Adventures with Extremists.
That's right. And if you can find it on YouTube, The Secret Rulers of the World.
Yeah. I apologize for the graininess, but it wasn't me who put it up there.
Thank you so much, John, for spending some time with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Blake. Great talking to you again.
Likewise. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and you just heard me interviewing John Ronson, author of the new book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. A link to this book and other selected works from Ronson will be in the show notes at monstertalk.org. By coincidence, the accusations Ike has made about secret pedophile rings operating in the UK has strong similarities to claims made in the United States, which I researched for an episode of the Skeptoid podcast, which also went live this week. That episode is on satanic ritual abuse and the story of how wild accusations led to people being jailed for years or decades without sufficient evidence that any of the claims took place. Sadly, many of the UK cases do appear to be real cases of child abuse, though Ike does wrap up all his accusations in the framework of satanic lizard people cultists being to blame. All the turquoise tracksuits in the world can't make that kind of dark stuff comical. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. As always, the opinions expressed on Monster Talk are those of myself, my guests, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Skeptic Society, Skeptic Magazine, or our cold-blooded, vertically pupiled, cave-dwelling reptile overlords. This is episode 97. There is still time to send in your contributions for episode 100. I'm delighted, just delighted, I say, at the responses so far. Thanks so much, and I hope you're able to contribute. Here's how.
Hello, listener. How would you like to be on Monster Talk? I don't have time to interview everyone, but I'd like to do something interesting for episode 100 of the show, and I'd like your help. Here's all you need to do. 1. Decide what your favorite monster is. 2. Record yourself digitally using this format. My name is blank, and my favorite monster is blank. Obviously, don't use the word blank. Fill in your actual information there. And then 3. Save that file and email it to me, blake@monstertalk.org. And here's the important part. Put the words episode 100 in the email subject. That's all you have to do. Send me your name and your favorite monster as an audio file and put episode 100 in the subject. Thanks for helping us make episode 100 extra fun.
Special thanks to the supporters who have donated to Monster Talk, D.R. Crane, Robert Smith, Scott Barber, and David Koch. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening. We'll be right back.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
I was running for Congress, exactly.
And you know, worked for Ford and Nixon and Reagan and both Bushes. And there's still those people out there that think, you know, Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney are actually lizards. Who, I mean, literally, there's people that think they're lizards from outer space.
Yeah, that's true.
Who eat human flesh. I don't know if anybody's ever asked you directly, sir, but are you a lizard?
I don't think
are you actually, can you just please give that a straight answer?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.